The Voice of America, VOA 1.
That's my girl.
There's not so many people like Liu Xiaobo, I should say, openly speak out.
A turn for the worse for China's Nobel laureate. It's Thursday, July 13th. This is VOA Asia. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Join us, too, on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, Chinese economic aid having less effect in Southeast Asia. Pakistanis learn Mandarin. An Indian-American congresswoman meets the Dalai Lama. Family planning. And your car might be drinking while driving. It's all on today's VOA Asia. The hospital treating ailing Chinese dissident Liu Xiaobo for late-stage liver cancer says the Nobel Peace Laureate is suffering from respiratory failure. The first hospital of China Medical University in the northeastern city of Shenyang posted a statement on its website saying Liu's family has refused to allow doctors to perform a tracheotomy, a procedure in which a tube is inserted into his windpipe to help him breathe. The hospital announced earlier in the day that the 61-year-old dissident is suffering from shock and organ failure. It added that blood clots have formed throughout his body. Chinese artist and dissident Ai Weiwei, who is currently in Berlin, has known Liu Xiaobo for about 30 years.
We were friends since the 1980s, before the Tiananmen student movement. And after that, he was sentenced. After he comes out, we have contacts. And even before he was arrested for this time, he had email contacts. Also, we had a dinner together once. And so I remember him as a very soft and intellectual kind of scholar. And he would never imagine who would be treated like this.
Liu was granted
medical. And he would never imagine the end is like this.
Who was granted medical parole in May after his cancer was diagnosed. Beijing has ignored pleas from the United States, Germany, and numerous human rights groups to allow him and his wife to go overseas so he can seek treatment, claiming he is too sick to travel and is getting the best medical care in China. Ai Weiwei says if the incident at Tiananmen Square wasn't able to affect the Beijing government, international outrage over Liu Xiaobo's situation won't either.
If you talk about the broad impact, I feel sorry to say there's very little impact. 89, the tank crashed the students' movement. Hundreds of people are dead. So if they can handle that kind of impact, this is nothing. You know, so I don't think there will be that much impact, but still, I get a lot of noise.
Two doctors from the United States and Germany visited Liu last weekend and declared him well enough to travel, but a video released earlier this week showed the visiting doctors praising their Chinese counterparts. The German embassy in Beijing issued a statement Monday criticizing China, noting that security organs are steering the process, not medical experts. Ai Weiwei says government policies in China are preventing that country's best minds from flourishing and advancing the nation.
There's not so many people like Liu Xiaobo, I should say, openly speak out. And China is still under very severe control of the so-called communist. And it's an authoritarian society. It crashed down any idea which has any question about the authority. So it's a society never allowed its best mind to survive.
Liu is a poet and human rights activist who was arrested after writing Charter 08, a manifesto calling for the democratic reforms in China, and awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in 2010 for his campaign for democracy and human rights. He was sentenced to 11 years in prison for inciting subversion of state power, a law often used by Chinese authorities to silence dissidents. These are among some of the top Asia stories trending on VOAnews.com. Philippine troops clash with communist rebels, leaves 9 dead. Malaysian state introduces public caning for Sharia crimes. 2 more deaths as Japan leader Abe visits flooded areas. Cambodia bans sand exports after environmental group pressure. China reports 35 Japanese detained on telecom fraud charges. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are found on Facebook at VOA Asia and on our VOAnews.com website. VOA Asia continues. China's use of economic aid to placate angry neighbors is still seen as effective in allowing it to consolidate its controversial claims in the South China Sea, but it's also showing early signs of wearing thin, a year after an international court rejected Beijing's legal basis for maritime claims that have put it at odds with much of Southeast Asia. At the request of the Philippines, a World Court Arbitration Tribunal in The Hague ruled in July 2016 that Beijing was violating other countries' exclusive economic zones in the South China Sea. Beijing rejected the decision, but has since stepped up aid and investment to 4 Southeast Asian countries. Analysts like Jay Botanbakal, director of the Institute for Maritime Affairs and Law of the Sea at the University of the Philippines, says China hopes that aid will deter other countries from filing another case in The Hague.
Even China is being careful in order to avoid the second case from being filed. It's forced to try to really increase economic ties.
Says 2,000 years of history shows it owns most of the tropical sea that overlaps exclusive economic zones established by Brunei, Malaysia, Vietnam, and the Philippines. In the year since the arbitration ruling, China pledged $24 billion to the Philippines, became the top investor and trading partner for Malaysia, stepped up talks with Vietnam on maritime cooperation, and became that country's top source of inbound tourism. Jonathan Spangler, director of the South China Sea think tank in Taipei, says China's spending shows no sign of stopping, nor does its construction of artificial islands for military use.
It's likely that the regional grouping will maintain a cautious approach in its relations with China, and that any statements or agreements will be watered down so as to avoid upsetting Beijing. Chinese policymakers know that now is as good a time as any to push forward with securitization of their maritime territorial claims.
Some experts warn of increasingly obvious flaws in the Chinese formula of aid in exchange for other countries keeping quiet about their maritime claims. Lee Hong-hape is a researcher in Singapore and says Vietnam angered China last month with exploration for oil in an overlapping area.
After the ruling last year by the arbitral tribunal, China does not have any legitimate claim over that area. China insists that it's still a disputed area, and they believe that Vietnam is violating a common understanding between the leaderships of two countries.
The Vietnamese foreign minister asked India this month for a stepped-up partnership agreement that includes naval boat production. Our thanks to Ralph Jennings in Taipei for sending us this story. Happening now in Asia, officials say Philippine troops clashed with communist rebels in the south, leaving 8 rebels and a soldier dead. On Monday, soldiers in the same province captured a camp of the rebels who have been waging one of Asia's longest-running Marxist insurgencies. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We hope your day is going well, and we're glad you're with us today on VOA Asia. The China-Pakistan Economic Corridor is a group of infrastructure projects currently underway in Pakistan. The aim is to quickly modernize Pakistan's infrastructure while strengthening its economy. Nasser Mahmood reports from Islamabad the promise of prosperity has promised Pakistanis to learn to speak Chinese.
Mandarin Chinese is what these children are studying at the Confucius Institute in Islamabad. These 5th to 7th graders are learning how to read and write China's official language. Li Zhumei has been working for the institute for more than 4 years.
They are good and they are very excited to learn Chinese. In Chinese language, the Chinese characters are very difficult. The students feel very difficult to write the Chinese characters.
More Pakistani students are learning Mandarin to take advantage of an anticipated investment of tens of billions of dollars by China.
The China-Pakistan Economic Corridor is coming up here. Many Chinese companies are investing here. They're going to need local workers. I think Pakistanis should learn about Chinese language and culture so that they could interact with Chinese people in a better way and work efficiently.
It equals to opportunity.
Faisal Mushtaq founded Roots Millennium Schools, a large private sector educational network in Pakistan. He thinks children need to learn Chinese to fully benefit from the changing climate in the country.
In order to promote regional connectivity, Mandarin is the future currency after English, which is a large universal language. This is the currency of trade in future.
Efforts are also underway to teach Pakistanis about Chinese culture. For these kids, it's learning Tai Chi, a Chinese martial art. For Nasser Mahmood in Islamabad, I'm Bejan Hamdard, VOA News.
This news alert from VOA Asia. Malaysian authorities have rounded up over 3,100 foreigners this month as part of a major crackdown on illegal immigration. The crackdown began July 1st, the day after the deadline for all undocumented foreign workers to register with the government, many working in construction or on plantations. All the big stories come your way through the day on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. VOA Asia continues. U.S. Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal, a Democrat from Hawaii, has recently returned from Germany, Belgium, India, and Nepal as part of a high-level congressional delegation that met with the Dalai Lama in Dharamsala. Congressman Jayapal is vice-ranking member of the House Budget Committee, a member of the House Subcommittee on Immigration and Border Security, and the first member of Congress who was born in India. She discusses immigration and meeting the Dalai Lama with VOA Mandarin reporter Peggy Chang.
It was an amazing meeting. I have been a big admirer of His Holiness the Dalai Lama for a long time. He's a good friend of the United States, a good friend of Nancy Pelosi. And so our trip really was to spend some time with him strategizing and thinking about how we make sure that we preserve the Tibetans' ability and right to practice their culture and their religion, and ultimately to return home and take, as he calls it, the middle path, not necessarily separating away, but being able to live autonomously and, you know, practice all of the parts of their lives that have been so important.
You were born in India, and you came to the United States when you were 16 years old, and this was the first time you went back to India as the U.S. Congressional member. What did that mean to you?
It was very moving, you know, to go back as the first Indian-American woman ever elected to the House of Representatives to a country that I actually was a citizen of India for longer than I've been a citizen of the United States, because it took me almost 18 years to get my citizenship. So even though I've been here since I was 16, I only became a citizen in 2000. So to now go back and be able to really be in a position where I can help to improve the relationships between the United States and India, and certainly not just India, but all of Asia. You know, I've lived most of my life all over Asia, in Indonesia, Singapore, I've worked in Thailand, I've worked all over the Asia-Pacific region, is a wonderful thing. And so I'm looking forward to being able to really focus some attention on our relationships with the Asia-Pacific region. But India in particular, obviously, very emotional for me. I did meet with the Prime Minister there. We went to Bombay, where my son was born, met with the American businesses there in the Chamber of Commerce. And I've always been so proud of India for our ability to, you know, have birthed some of the major religions of the world and have them live harmoniously, for our generosity with the Tibetans and the Dalai Lama, allowing the government in exile to be there, but also for our tremendous history innovation. You look at some of the early cultures in India, the infrastructure that they built in the villages was remarkable. Now, we have a lot of challenges in India with poverty and many other things, but I do believe that it is a rich culture. And we have many countries that have that in the Asia-Pacific region.
You have been a champion for immigration reform and protecting civil liberties in the United States since 2000. You sit on the Subcommittee on Immigration and Border Security. You are also a strong critic of President Trump's immigration policy. Can you share us why you think that President Trump's immigration policy is not beneficial for the United States, and what kind of immigration reform would you like to see?
Yeah, as you mentioned, I ended up starting the largest, what is now the largest immigrant advocacy organization in Washington State, one of the largest in the country, and was very proud to work on the 2013 immigration bill that passed the U.S. Senate with 67 bipartisan votes. It's hard to remember that it was not that long ago that we had that kind of incredibly strong bipartisan support for reforming our broken immigration system. And I think that it's unfortunate that this president and this administration has been sort of whipping up anger and tensions against immigrants, because when you think about it, just on a values level, the United States is a country that was built by immigrants, willing and unwilling. Unless you were Native American, your ancestors came from somewhere else in the world. Chinese laborers built the railroads in the Pacific Northwest. We've had so much value from immigrants who have helped to build this country, and we are all a nation of immigrants. It's a part of who we are as Americans. But even economically, if you look at the fact that our immigration system has not been reformed in decades, so there's been no comprehensive fixes that adjust for the needs of our economies, the needs of our families, the needs of this country. And that has been because this anti-immigrant sentiment is easy to whip up sometimes. But even now, in a bipartisan way, economists agree that if we were to pass immigration reform, comprehensive immigration reform, we would bring $1.5 trillion into our economy. Even now, economists on both sides of the aisle agree that if we were to pursue the harsh immigration policies of the Trump administration, from the Muslim ban to mass deportation to the criminalization of undocumented immigrants, the American economy would suffer tremendously. And this was testimony that was presented to us on the Budget Committee, where I'm the vice-ranking member of the Budget Committee. Economists from the majority side, former very highly placed economist in Republican administration, said that this would be a disaster for the country if we were to pursue these policies. So yes, I've been a big critic of the Trump administration. You know, I think that it's an enormous disservice to the values of this country, to the Statue of Liberty, and to the history of who we are. Immigration has never been just about immigration. It's always been about who we are as a country and what we're willing to stand up for.
Our thanks to Mandarin reporter Peggy Chong and Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal of Hawaii for speaking with VOA. Developing at this hour in Asia, authorities in Afghanistan confirm that an alleged torture and sexual assault case against the country's first vice president has been sent to court for further action. A spokesman in Kabul told VOA the charges were investigated with complete impartiality. Top stories and great features to share are found daily on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation has announced a big increase in funding to contraceptive programs. The pledge was made as delegates from across the globe gathered Tuesday for the Family Planning Summit in London. But as Henry Ridgewell reports, proposed cuts to family planning programs by the U.S. government overshadowed the conference.
Several donor countries attending the summit pledged to increase family planning funding, with the largest amount from the US-based Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation to boost women's access to contraceptives.
The $375 million that the foundation announced today, that is absolutely not a reaction to President Trump. There is nothing anyone can do to fill the bucket of the money that the U.S. has committed to family planning.
The United States is by far the biggest donor to global family planning programs, giving $600 million this year. But President Donald Trump announced in April he plans to withdraw financial support for the United Nations Population Fund, accusing it of using what he called coercive family planning practices, including providing abortions. The UN strongly rejects the claims.
Every country in the developing world will be worried, because it really signifies an increase in the gap. We know family planning is one of the strongest anti-poverty strategies the world has ever known. It's a low-hanging fruit for reducing maternal mortality. It will contribute to shared prosperity.
By 2050, Nigeria is on course to be the third most populous country, with more than 400 million people.
Our economy cannot grow fast enough to be able to sustain that size of population. So it's a very significant challenge, and we need to address it now.
My friend and I, we just wanted to find out about family planning. Safe sex, actually.
Governments say reaching young people is key. The African MTV drama Sugar weaves messages around sexual health, contraception and HIV, and reaches an estimated 720 million people. It is currently partly funded by the US government.
Come back here!
It's much harder for governments and organisations to be able to speak very openly about sex. That's where we come in. We can use our brand, we can use our access to young people and all of the media platforms that they use.
Delegates expressed hope that partnering between the private sector and governments can provide improved access to contraceptives and family planning advice. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
We all know that drinking and driving don't mix, but what if it were your car that is consuming the alcoholic beverage? Well, at least perhaps part of it. Researchers in Scotland found a profitable way to use byproducts of whiskey production to power cars without any modifications to the engines. VOA's George Pudich sips on this energetic possibility.
Each year, the Scottish whiskey industry spends almost $400,000 to dispose of 827,000 tons of grainy barley kernels called draff and about 2 billion litres of a gooey liquid called pot ale. Edinburgh-based Celtic Renewables decided to use an old fermentation process to turn it into fuel. At a recent demonstration, a clear liquid called biobutanol was added to the tank of an ordinary Ford car.
It's quite fitting to use a Ford for this historic drive, as the original Model T Ford ran on biofuel, and the fermentation that we've developed to put the fuel in this car is 100 years old, proven at large scale.
Biobutanol can comprise up to 15% of the gasoline mixture without any modifications to the car's fuel system. It is also less corrosive than ethanol and blends with diesel as well as gasoline.
The opportunities for us in making fuel from the residues of the whiskey industry are absolutely enormous, and this could be a giant industry that provides economic and environmental sustainability to one of the biggest industries in the country.
With financial support from the Scottish Government, Celtic Renewables plans to open a factory next year with an annual capacity of 500,000 litres of biobutanol. But the potential is much greater, as the Scottish whiskey industry creates enough of the raw materials to scale up that production 100 times. George Pudich, VOA News, Washington.
Perhaps we'll be saying bottoms up and into the tank. You've been listening to VOA Asia. Be sure to join us online at voanews.com and on Facebook at VOA Asia Facebook. Our director today is Tracy Carter, engineer Jim Harmon, managing editor Diane Gao. Ali Ogden and David Byrd are on our VOA Asia team. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We hope you have a great day ahead.